Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about solidarity, Joe. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, an American Freedom Radio, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island-chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific, irradiated with the fabulous Fukushima rays, and everybody has a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. Welcome, one and all. My very special guest today, I was wondering if we could kind of get you, Joe Carolyn from Socialist Aotearoa, also on with Will Ryan from the RNZ Party, and for a little bit of a debate. And Will showed up yesterday and you showed up today. So,
yeah, but Vinny, I got to work.
All right. Oh, yes, we all do. We all do in our various ways and ends, don't we? The scary part I find is, Joe, is that the fact of the matter remains, we have to work, we have to work, we have to work, whether or not that work actually does any good for anybody.
Oh, well, I like to think that the work that I do does good, yeah. That's why I chose to do the work that I do. I'm sure I could have got a job in marketing or with one of the bigger right-wing parties or so-called left-wing parties and had a very pleasurable lifestyle, but I've chosen to work with the poor. I've chosen to work with low-paid workers, casualized workers, and that's kind of more a mission for me than a job, but yeah, it's actually a privilege to do the work that I do, I think. But it does take up my time, unfortunately. So, yeah, Saturday is a good time to talk to you, brother.
Okay. We'll try and keep that in mind. And if Will's around, hopefully he might drop in. We're also expecting Ben Vigen, who's from Postman Productions, the Deadline Gazette down in the South Island. Probably, it's kind of like Investigate magazine, from the South. You know,
good stuff.
So, yeah, it's going to be an interesting wee panel discussion if anything turns out whatsoever, because I find that the more brilliant minds you put in a room, the better the conversation becomes, because it becomes this nice flowing mishmash of different facts and opinions and stuff everywhere. It's brilliant. And I think we should all try and saturate ourselves with a lot of different views and opinions. So otherwise, we get kind of stagnant.
Well, I think that's been kind of my working practice, kind of building movements, building broad movements of people where there are a diversity of ideas and groups, and always trying to build the maximum unity possible so we can achieve common goals has kind of been one of the methods that we use, that we work. I mean, however, there's also strong philosophical contradictions or disagreements amongst different groups within these movements for social change. And I think it's good to be honest that I've never hidden my politics from anyone. I'm quite proud of them. And I know that well, it is, so I'm quite looking forward to a good, rigorous, 15 rounds of intellectual heavyweight boxing.
Heavyweight boxing. Have you noticed that that's kind of what politics has become? It's become this sort of this meat-headed fight. This name-calling. This attempt to knock the other out. It's not a focus. They don't seem to have a focus of actually improving the country. They seem to have the focus of destroying their opposition. Their opposition, of course, being the country.
Well, do you think so, actually? I think it's just a show. I think they do that in Parliament and call each other names and behave like school kids. But actually, they agree. There's a consensus, consensus, whatever you want to call it, a consensus around neoliberalism, a consensus that we have to put profits before people, a consensus when it comes to things like war and the occupation of other countries by their armies. I mean, you tell me the fundamental disagreements between any of these, bigger political groups. I mean, I think actually that's what you're starting to see in many Western countries. Different groups starting to emerge from below who are just tired of this kind of Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, golden straitjacket, I think Thomas Friedman, who's a writer from the right, who wrote, was it The Lexus and the Olive Tree? But he talks about how when a society gains a certain amount of wealth, and that wealth comes from an exploitative system that exploits both the planet, the so-called third world, and workers in their own home countries, that the so-called oppositional parties actually get bought off by the system, incorporated into the system, get rewards for running that system in a so-called fair way, but leaving intact the very process of exploitation, ecological destruction, whatever, with just some window dressing. So I actually don't think that we do see any rigorous political debate in Parliament or on the media or whatever. As Chomsky says, I mean, if you're going to present a radical critique of the system in anything less than 2 or 3 minutes, on the media, in the mainstream media, you'll just come across as someone who's, just out of the picture, as someone whose ideas are just far too radical. They won't give you enough time to actually properly explain
your
fundamental critique. Exactly, yeah, exactly. So that's how actually the function of media reinforces this very, very thin bandwidth of political ideas that are accepted as common sense. Those ideas gain hegemony because most other people are never presented with radical critiques that are given enough time to be properly explained at all. So, yeah, we do see any rigorous heavyweight boxing when it comes to talking about, political ideas in most Western so-called democracies.
What is a democracy really? It's like people get to vote for whether or not they get enslaved from underneath or enslaved from above. I think that's what democracy is basically turned into. Because I don't think in a democracy people recognize that there's no inalienable rights, some personal sovereignty or personal responsibility sort of thing sort of starts to go out the window. And we stop thinking about ourselves as being the most important, most responsible person in our life that can get everything done. And we start thinking that instead the government should do it, the government should pay for this, the government should do that and what have you. And it just lends ourselves to just being kind of lazy, apathetic, and easily conquered.
Yeah, I'm all in favor of getting rid of governments. And that'll be interesting to see how much I'm with Will. What does democracy really mean? Well, the Greek root form demokratos means the voice of the people. I think what we have now is a perversion. It isn't democracy at all. It's an excuse to vote for Tweedledum or Tweedledummer every 3 to 5 years. They get elected and they go and do whatever they want anyway. There's no, we don't have a system of recall. So if a politician lies or if they cheat or if they're corrupt, the people who elected them can actually fire them, get rid of them and replace them with someone who will actually do what they did promise contractually, if you like, at the polls. I come from a revolutionary socialist tradition, which is what are all to do with the Labour parties of the world. And our big inspiration was the Paris Commune 1870, where the people of Paris rose up in revolution, the first ever working class revolution in the world. They ran Paris off for a few years before they were massacred, which was known as the Paris Commune. Very, very interesting. And the basic two principles they had were ones that I think we should have in democracies today. First, there were no privileges at all for anyone who was elected to the commune. And they were elected not just in geographical areas, but they were elected by where they worked, by their community, you know, by their street, but by who they were as well, the kind of work that they did. So this idea that you'd have democracy, not just down in a parliament in some kind of feudal Westminster kind of, Oak Hall, of high elves. And they're the only ones who, the great and the good, who decide things. This idea that democracy would be rooted in the workplace, in the very place where people spend most of their lives, and no privileges at all, no extra pay, no Mercedes or BMWs or expensive. We're just on the ordinary working wage that most of the people that they represented were on. I think that keeps people honest. I think it makes them less corrupt because they got a vested interest in seeing the standards rise if they're actually on the average income that they represent. The second principle of the Paris Commune was that they were immediately recallable. That any local group could, if they didn't like the way that their delegate voted, and the delegate had to report back to the people about how they voted, it'd be immediately callable, sacked on the spot, and replaced again. You didn't have to wait for 3 years or 5 years. Now, this was, in 1870, a long time before things like electronic democracy and, technology, the internet and stuff. I mean, how easy would it be to organize that today? Easier, And so those are two principles I think we could have, no matter what ideology that you have.
Essentially, what you're talking about is appropriate representation in a proper place and not having, not being way too far above everybody else so that they lose touch with the people, and not to mention they can be instantly taken out if the people wish it. I think that's pretty straightforward.
I think we should be able to instantly take out politicians, don't you?
But not in the JFK sense of the word. We have a very special guest who's calling in. It's Ben Vigen calling in from New Zealand. Ben, welcome.
Good morning, Vinny. How are you doing there?
Fabulous, mate. How are you?
Not too bad. Just had a few technical issues this morning, so I'm sorry I'm running a bit behind schedule, but we're all here now. So what can we do for you this on this fine Saturday morning?
You just released an article about this this Indonesian quake and everything, and I know nothing about it, but I know if anybody who can explain a whole crap load that will scare the bejesus out of you with the truth, it'll be you.
Oh, thank you very much, Vinny. Hey, basically, what the situation's happened with the Indonesian earthquake is that it initially got my attention because, as you know, on various shows that I've been on beforehand, when certain factors start happening repeatedly, it always grabs my attention, and this Indonesian quake is rapidly falling into that category. And now, basically, for those who aren't familiar with it, I've been studying the High Altitude Atmospheric Research Program for some time, which is one of its allegations made against it, is that it's a geo-warfare weapon or can basically cause earthquakes. Now, I want to make it very clear from the start that I don't say that HART necessarily can do this. I mean, the proof is simply not in one way or the other, but once you start sort of adding up all the factors, you got to start taking this as a consideration quite seriously. So basically what my blog, which is on www.postmanproductions.org, sort of looks at is these various factors. And, the first thing about the Indonesian earthquake is that, somebody actually already predicted it quite accurately beforehand, and there's a link there which is on www.godlikeproductions.com, which relates to that issue, which goes into kind of the geopolitical factors of what's happening in Indonesia with these sort of oil prices. The second factor which I looked at, sort of apart from the fact that I've been called in, was that, not necessarily that HARP is actually causing earthquakes, but what it might simply be doing is actually monitoring them in relation to what's actually happening in relation to space. I mean, this is a key point. Every time an earthquake occurs, the media rushes off, they speak to a geologist, and the geologist gives them their version. But if you turn around and you sort of start talking to various astrophysicists, they actually believe that, you know, if an asteroid passes by or a solar flare occurs, this can also actually trigger off an earthquake. And this is something way back in 2005 when I wrote my first article. I mean, this is the same situation. There was an asteroid, I think it was called Toulouse, passing by at the time. Now we have another asteroid, this high level of solar flare activity. So quite potentially, you know, what we may be dealing with is actually space-related weather. So, you know, once I sort of started looking at that point, I thought, well, you know, maybe HAARP, you know, not causing this at all. But a lot of the thing is that people will often point to the fact that the HAARP station based in Alaska is actually active at the time. But I'm saying, well, maybe it's not actually causing it. Maybe it's simply observing it. The only problem with that particular theory occurs is that when you start adding up a whole bunch of other factors, you kind of find yourself going, well, yeah, maybe it's observing it, but maybe it's more than that, because it's, you know, and for example, in June 2010, there was an earthquake in Turkey and Greece, and it wasn't just that it had the sort of the space activity occurring. What was also occurring at the particular time was that all up and down the Mediterranean, there was a whole series of factors that indicated there was a high level of electromagnetic activity in the area, and this included substations blowing up, jets dropping out of the skies, whales washing up on the beach. But it also happened to coincide at the time that basically Greece was having to decide whether or not it was going to accept the IMF default or not. And this is what happens quite often is when you start looking at the troop movement. Sorry, Vinny?
No, I wasn't saying anything.
Okay, so when you start looking at sort of things like troop movements, geopolitical, it's all too convenient. And, you know, what basically sort of makes me think is that we have to start considering the fact that it's not just a case of observing, but actually participant is, from an artillery intelligence viewpoint, you're seeing the same events, you're seeing the same people, the same equipment. And this equipment, when you actually look at the history of it, its purpose, the money that's gone into it, is actually for geo-warfare. You can go back
indeed.
To the 1950s.
Hold on a sec there, Ben. Hold on a sec there, Ben. We'll have to get into this after the break. I've got Joe Carolyn and Ben Vigen with us back in a minute at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. Join us in the chat room.
Because it's Wednesday, and Wednesday night is the night that we usually make love. It's because it's when everything is just right. There's nothing good on TV. You haven't had your social netball team practice, so you're not too tired. Oh yeah, sounds like it's all on. You say something to me like, I might go to bed, I've got work in the morning. But I know what you mean. You mean, oh yeah, it's business time, it's business time.
It's business, it's business time.
That's what you mean it's business time. Oh.
It's business, it's business time.
Oh yeah,
that's right.
That's right. We go brush our teeth, that's all part of it, that's foreplay.
Welcome to the show that's all about
that's
foreplay.
Not part of it, but it's still very important.
It's political foreplay. It's the Vinny Eastwood show. Sexiest 2 hours in talk radio, wearing ugly baggy t-shirts that I got from my old work. My very special guest is Joe Carolyn. We also have Ben Vigen. And Ben, you were kind of talking about, you said there was a little bit of history behind the HAARP facility and what have you. Ben, can you hear me? Apparently not. All right. Well, anyway, Ben, you'll have to probably hang up and call back then if you can still hear me, because we have some technical difficulties with the phones sometimes. But, well, I guess we could shift gears then and start talking more about the political side. Now, what's happening here in New Zealand? We're having a lot of state assets being destroyed. And in today's case, it's going to be quite literal, isn't it, Joe? Could you fill us all in?
Yeah, well, we've got pretty, how would I describe it, right-wing government in New Zealand who wants to sell off all the family silver, They want to sell off the electricity companies. They want to, they've been attacking our wharfies down at the port of Auckland, which is state-owned. And then today, there's wrecking crews out smashing up state housing out in eastern part of Auckland called Glen Innes, which has kind of always been a strong working class area. It's where a lot of Maori and Pacific Island people were shipped out to when they gentrified Ponsonby, the kind of which is now the trendy area of the city centre. It used to be a good working class area of Auckland. And now they're doing the same thing 50, 60 years later. Now, the annoying thing about what's happened in Glen Innes is that these houses were built for heroes. The working class had fought not one but two world wars, had been through the Depression, you know, had suffered a lot for so-called democracy, returned from battlefields of mostly Italy and North Africa with the Kiwi soldiers, and were promised housing fit for kings in GI. And the houses, a lot of the street names out there actually named after the battle fields of North Africa, and although the state kind of owned these houses, that it was the understanding that the families of the soldiers and those who'd made the ultimate sacrifice would live in these houses, and these houses would be decent houses, not those slums that the working class used them. Now, 50, 60 years later, we decided that housing is not a right for people, that it's another thing to make huge amounts of profit out of. And indeed, a lot of workers, low-paid workers, are paying more than half their income now in rent to private landlords. One of the main obstacles that the profiteers have at the moment is that there's still a reasonable stock of state housing in New Zealand. This people of the GI is just the first wave of attacks on state housing in general in New Zealand. And if they can evict people, and then if they can physically destroy these houses, what they can get at is the land underneath the houses as well, which is extremely valuable. It's a beautiful part of Auckland that overlooks the bay. You can build mansions on this and sell them to the rich, and then you can ship all the people off and build some European-style high-rise blocks for them. So it's a battle for the soul of Auckland, I suppose, as well. I mean, in the 70s here, there was a big standoff between the state and Maori people up at another beautiful part of Auckland called Bastion Point, and that became rallying cry. Not just for the Maori people, but for everybody in New Zealand who thought that we should have a more just society here, that this country was based on the theft of land from the indigenous people. Now, this battle out in GI, I suppose, is the bastion point of our generation. And although there are many Maori people living in GI, there's also a lot of working class Pacifica and Pakeha, white New Zealanders, European New Zealanders, and they're all united and saying, well, this is the bastion point of our generation, the bastion point of the working class. This isn't ethnic cleansing, this is social cleansing. They want to wipe out the working class community, build the mansions there, and treat us like dirt. And that's why today a lot of us are putting our bodies in sledgehammers and the chainsaws that are literally destroying state houses today.
What time do they do to kick off the demolition?
Well, the demolitions have been going on for a couple of days. They do this. People are at work, so people are rallying there Saturday at 3 p.m.
Well, I think that's an idea. And we have Ben Vigen calling back. And Ben, are you there?
Yeah, I am indeed, Benny. How's your day going?
We're going
good. Can you hear me?
Yep.
All right, Lex. Okay, so basically, well, let's have a look at the history of old, good old HAARP. And what we're going to do is we're going to fast forward all the way to Australia in 1993.
And I like this. This is all back and forth jumping between topics. It's quite random but awesome. All right, keep going, Ben. Sorry.
All right. Well, what I thought I'd do is provide a little bit of the history, then people actually understand how it relates to Indonesia. In May of 1993, the city of Perth was woken up by a large meteorite that exploded over the city, and at the same time, there was an actual earthquake. Now, basically, to cut a long story short, when they discovered what the epicenter of the meteorite was, it turned out to be the same place where the earthquake had occurred, which was basically about 3 kilometres west of Laverton, which today is where the Royal Australian Air Force actually have their electronic weapons station. However, at the time, this was actually a farm, and it had been purchased 35 days beforehand by the Japanese cult Umshirinko. Now, the cult, these are the same guys that actually, not only did they predict the earthquake in Kobe in 1993, but they then went on in 1995 to release sarin gas into Tokyo, which sort of made several thousand people sick and killed, I think it was about 100 people or so. Now, what they actually discovered is, when they went back and actually had a look at the cult, was what they actually discovered was that they'd actually been playing around with different sort of electromagnetic equipment. The Australian federal government actually hadn't kicked them out. They knew about it. They'd let them into Australia. That this was even brought up in 1993 in Parliament. Christine Chamaret addressed the Minister of Immigration, Nick Bolkus, and said, you know, why didn't we kick these people out? He said, look, I think you must be mistaken. 2 years later, the cult carried out its terrorist attack, and now I'm going to read you directly from the New York Times, and basically this is what the cult had to say when they actually turned around and investigated what they'd actually been actually up to. This is from the New York Times. Still one of the remote but still worrisome possibilities remain. The Umshirinko had apparently studied seismic warfare and artificially triggering earthquakes, a terrifying prospect for quake-prone Japan. Many geophysicists view seismic warfare as fantasy that is highly unlikely to ever materialize. Even so, the study had been quietly studied for decades by governments worldwide, including the Soviet Union and the United States during the Cold War. Now, they had two investigations into this, one in Australia and one into the US, which the public results of the investigations were inconclusive, but the US study was actually chaired by a guy called Sam Nunn. And in his study, he went on to then host a symposium on weapons of mass destruction in 1998, where the key speaker on the symposium was the Secretary of Defense, William Cohen, who then went on to state, others are engaging even in eco-type of terrorism, whereby they can alter the climate, set off earthquakes, volcanoes remotely for using electromagnetic weapons. It's real, and that's the reason why we have to intensify our efforts. So, one of the key signs that they knew about this testing was the fact that we had sonic booms going off, there were meteorites occurring in the sky. These were exactly what you were seeing in the Indonesian earthquake in Boxing Day in 2005. From about 2 weeks to 3 weeks beforehand, you were getting newspaper reports as far south as Dunedin, as far north as Jakarta, that were showing all these particular symptoms. So after 2005, you know, the Boxing Day tsunami, a lot of people started to investigate, and then they started to actually discover that there wasn't just the sonic booms and the bright explosions that were giving away the signs. There were other symptoms of electromagnetic activity. For example, when scientists turned around and went back and looked at the Indonesian earthquake that occurred, that there was actually an earthquake the week beforehand in Macquarie Island. I'm going to come to this because this is the issue of when you start getting, you know, large earthquakes occurring in the same areas that defy mathematics, that's one part of the factor. But what they actually discovered on Macquarie Island was that there had been symptoms of basically that there had been a disturbance in the electromagnetic atmosphere directly above Macquarie when they'd had the 8.0. This same symptom has actually since then it's shown up in the earthquakes in Japan, showing up in earthquakes in Haiti, even more recently, and this is where we start looking at the current day event. Just a couple of weeks ago, there was a whole series of tornadoes that turned around and hit the southern parts of the US. What they discovered when scientists went back and looked at them was, again, they had this strange electro anomaly that was starting to actually show up in the atmosphere. In other words, it wasn't just you having an earthquake where the pressure was coming from below, but there appeared to be some kind of pressure or stimulant actually occurring at the upper atmosphere. So,
an earthquake that came from above.
In a nutshell, but yes, basically. So, you know, this is what we start to look at when we start to look at the earthquakes that start happening in Christchurch. Was again these ball lightnings were occurring. The front page of the Christchurch Press the day before the Boxing Earthquake actually has one of these ball lightnings on the front page of it. But, you know, what was also occurring during the Christchurch earthquakes was there was, again, there was a whole raft of aircraft that were being knocked down along the west coast. There were dolphins being beached actually up on the around the areas. And this has happened virtually every single major earthquake that's happened in Christchurch. There's been a large raft of dolphins occurring just before the earthquakes. And if you know, if those people have been paying attention, you know, over a week ago, we just had over 3,000 dolphins washed up on Peru. Now, what's interesting about the dolphins that are washed up in Peru is that this is directly where the southern Atlantic anomaly is, and this is where just over a week ago, what NASA actually did was that they turned around and they fired a whole series of rockets directly into that Atlantic anomaly. Now, the program was known as Atarax, and this is quite interesting because what Atarax has done is actually effectively a repeat of Project Argus, where they exploded large nuclear devices into the high atmosphere, and this actually resulted in the Russians taking the US to the United Nations and saying, "Well, you've just messed up the electromagnetic, you know, field by doing this." And papers were written in 1970 saying, "Well, you know, don't do this again." But yet we've got just had a series of four or five rockets that have been doing exactly this. And when you actually follow that line, it's quite interesting because on my blog you see that the flight path of that actually goes, you know, through South America and then basically cut straight through Indonesia. I mean, some of the other factors, when I started to look at what was actually going down in Indonesia, just to fast forward.
I'd like to interject something here because I saw this video the other day that looked like a tornado made of fire, and all these burnt dolphins and fish and stuff like that were turning up everywhere. Have you heard about this?
Yeah, I haven't seen the fire. I've heard very briefly. I haven't really done much study actually on it, but you're right. I mean, we are seeing a huge raft of, you know, animals all around the world which are dying, and they have to be careful there because there are a number of factors going on there, and not all necessarily these animals are dying from the same thing. But, you know, when you turn around and you start looking at the sort of the overall, if you want, forensic signatures, you know, what I've got is over 11 signatures, which kind of make me think, hey, what's going on in Indonesia is highly unusual. And that, you know, like we talked about the multiple quakes. When they had the earthquake in Indonesia in 2005, that was, an 8.9, or might have been registered up to 9.1. This occurred exactly a week before the Macquarie Island, which was 8.0. Now, normally in a year, you only have one actual 8-plus earthquake. Here, you actually had two occurring, and this is exactly what we've seen occurred this week. We've had two 8-plus earthquakes. In fact, we had more than five 7-plus earthquakes occur within 24 hours. Now, to break that down, around the world, you have, on an average year, you have around about 50,000 earthquakes that occur every year. Only about 6% of them are ever greater than 4%. But if you actually start looking at the math of the earthquakes that have been occurring in the last week alone, you're seeing that figure is greatly raised. And even the weeks before, on March 23rd and March 27th, there were two earthquakes that occurred in Alice Springs. The first one was registered at over 5+. The second earthquake registered at 6+. Now, again, that's quite unusual because what geologists always like to point out to us is that when you have an earthquake, the aftershocks occur for quite some time, but they generally go on down on a sloping scale. But here we have Alice Springs, which is nowhere near any fault lines. It happens to be exactly where one of the part of the Australian Heart Network is, called Jaune, and you've got two earthquakes occurring there, and the second one is actually much larger than the first one, as pointed
out. That's strange in and of itself, because it's usually the big ones come first and the smaller aftershocks come later. Well, hold on a sec back there. We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen. We're doing good.
Hey, my biggest problem, mate, is I'm all linked up, but when I'm on the Skype page, I can't actually figure out how to get into the actual get it turned on, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm not sure what's happening with Skype, eh? I mean, did you update to the new Skype recently? I mean, welcome back to the show, everybody. We're going to talk about some technical issues here. Because we tried Skype, the new Skype yesterday, Ben. And what happened was all my audio starts cutting out when the music comes on. And it's really messed up. It's like these people upgrade their programs that we do the shows on, and they upgrade them to something that's even worse. And apparently there's problems like this that happen quite a lot of the time. In fact, there's a new version that's come out for anybody who's a Skype user. Just came out yesterday, I think, because there was a lot of bugs with that particular release yesterday. So that's the technology news segment of the show over and done with. So at the moment, we have to deal with technical difficulties, as often happens in talk radio. It's part of the game. Makes everything a lot more exciting. So, Ben, speak of technical difficulties. Harp technical difficulties. Can you imagine what would happen if you accidentally fired one of those babies with a billion watts of megawatts of energy astray? Ben, are you there? Oh, you'll have to call back, Ben, if you're not with us. Joe, are you there?
I am indeed, Ben.
All right. Okay. Well, see, this is what I'm talking about. Happens all the time. And you just got to roll with it. Roll with it, ladies and gentlemen. Don't worry. Don't freak out. Do you see that with a lot of people, Joe, when things are sort of going a bit awry, they sort of freak out and they start yelling, screaming, swearing, whatever?
Yeah, stuff happens, bro. Hey, you know, you gotta be calm. Stay calm and organize.
I think it's more to the point that if you start to get aggravated and frustrated and act like everything's a big deal, you wind up getting yourself in an early grave. You know, you're stressing yourself out. You're full of all that negativity, all that negative energy that you're pumping out in response to everything. Goodness sake, it couldn't be worse. And Ben, you're back, aren't you?
Good morning. Okay, third time's a charm. Okay, so we were talking about the different symbols, and we'd already talked about basically the earthquakes in Alice Springs. We talked about the mass dolphin strikes. The third thing, which really got me interesting, was that this year, the sprite season, which I'll explain what a sprite and an elf and a blue jet is very shortly, but it's actually kicked off 3 months ahead of what normally happens. Now, for those who aren't aware, the sprites, blue jets, and elves are actually, these are large plasma storms that actually occur somewhere between the ionosphere and the stratosphere and Earth, and they're actually a very, very important part of HAARP. But my belief is that actually what occurs is that when they've got, quite often people who are against HAARP say, oh no, you can't do that, signal propagation, which is simply the loss of signal strength, won't allow that to occur. But what I actually believe occurs is that these guys aren't dumb, and they actually prime the conditions ideally. So one of the methodologies of priming, the chemtrails, spraying out barium, it's a refractive material, that's really good for getting your signal boosted up. Second thing is you've got all these storms that occur all around the Earth naturally. And now, just to give an idea of how much power we're talking about, you imagine a lightning bolt. Well, a sprite is a lightning bolt that's about 20 miles wide, and basically, you know, it's a lightning bolt on crack. And these things occur all the time.
It's like a lightning bolt that's like 50 or 100 times bigger than a lightning bolt.
Way more. And the thing about it is that, you know, the civilian scientists, you know, they've only actually had access to knowing about Sprite in the last 10 to 15 years, but primarily because that's the first time the military's actually allowed them on board, and you have to use a very high-speed camera to even capture them. The military, on the other hand, have actually been studying Sprites for quite considerable times, and one of the chaps that I speak to is a guy called Dr. Craig Roger, who's a scientist down here at Otago University. He's actually commissioned to by NASA to see what happens when you fly a shuttle for a sprite storm, and he gave it about odds of about 1 in 100 chance of actually blowing up, which is quite interesting because the last shuttle that actually went through the sprite storm, they blew up. That's exactly what it was doing. It was flying for a sprite storm. It was using a multi-spectrum lens, which
was that the Columbia.
Pardon? That's correct.
Was
yeah,
that the Columbia.
Columbia or the Challenger. But the gentleman at the time that was actually the experiments they were engaged was actually studying these, and the guy that was studying them, or the paymaster, was a guy called Colonel Raymond, Colonel Elon Ramon, who was the Israeli Air Force's electronic weapons specialist. He was the guy that basically did all the E-dub when the Israelis attacked the Iraqi reactors in 1981. He had just come over from the Israeli Air Force, where he was the head of weapons procurement, and that was his last ride. And the guy that was actually piloting the shuttle at the time, which was Commander McCool, he also happened to be an electronics weapons expert. Now, what they had on board the shuttle, as well as they had in the Hubble, is they actually have these things which are basically multi-spectrum lenses, which allow them to see, you know, where these storms occur. And what I believe occurs is that they actually, you know, they aim HAARP at these devices, and then they basically bounce the signal into the ground. The ground itself is actually basically molten plasma. So really all they're doing is taking you like a pot of water on an element, turning it on and turning the heat up. And, of course, when you get, you know, water molecules, they get all excited and they start bubbling. Well, you imagine you do that with plasma, which is, you know, energy to the power of oxygen several thousand times over. You get quite a dramatic kind of impact. And as I said, you know, if you go online, you start, you know, Googling sprites, there's some really good YouTube clips out there which sort of show you actually how impressive they are. And these things have gone off about 3 months beforehand. And at the same time that they're going off, you're now getting tornadoes in the southern parts of the United States that actually have this very unique electromagnetic signal. You're getting extreme borealis activity. Like, again, you know, when I grew up, I was always told that you can only see aurora borealis if you're down here in Dunedin, which is like the far end, the far southern part of the world, or the very far north up in Alaska. But if you start reading the newspapers, suddenly it's become quite normal to see aurora borealis as far south as Puerto Rico. And you're like, you know, that's a neat little trick. The other thing that we saw was this issue about the earthquakes, was that you've seen large multiple earthquakes occurring simultaneously, which, if you just simply take out and look at the maps, you know, that itself is showing that the standard geology playbook is not actually working. So even if you don't necessarily believe that HAARP does cause earthquakes, it's certain that there is obviously some other factor going on, and possibly, you know, the media guys need to start talking to a few other disciplines and realizing that there are actually alternative theories out there which equally describe causes for earthquakes which go beyond simple geology and what's going on down and below. You know, what goes up can affect what happens below. As I mentioned,
what I find interesting is that every time there seems to be a major earthquake, you could just assume that it's HAARP, and then you look into it, and there's a lot of HAARP phenomenon with those mostly major earthquakes.
And that's the thing, is that, you know, you've got to take into account. I mean, I look at it from you know, my background, which is artillery intelligence, and it's not just that one of these things is occurring. It's the same thing is occurring in multiple cases time and time again. And when you start looking at, you know, in terms of the manpower, in terms of what NASA's doing or what station happens to be there, you know, it's the same personnel and the same money trail that's appearing again and again and again. And from my viewpoint, you know, if I was, you know, sent out in the field and we're being bombed all the time and I trace it back to the same people, you know, that would grab my attention. Like, you know, the same situation we were talking about the unusual aurora borealis. Like last year, in fact, over the last 6 months, I've had lots of reports in Australia of sonic booms and that gets blamed on the Air Force. And in one of the cases, yes, there was the big exercise Sabre Tiger. At the time when Sabre Tiger occurred, there was a huge aurora borealis over Australia. And if you read the fine print of Sabre Tiger, you actually discover that part of that the exercise, which actually also, oddly enough, involved with FEMA and the Department of Agriculture, also involved scientific interest and a huge electrical weapons component to it as well. And they're saying, like, you know, just on April 3rd, another mass meteorite sighting over New Zealand, broad daylight, everyone actually saw it. Step forward again, you're seeing these unusual cloud activity around Indonesia minutes before the earthquakes. Last 3 days, there have been reports coming in that people are seeing chemtrail activities and a huge level activity. Now, again, some people don't necessarily believe in chemtrails, but when I start seeing a huge spike in reports from people seeing the same thing all around, again, this is all part of the, come on, guys, you know, how many times do you have to believe in a coincidence theory before you start realizing that maybe something actually is going on? And, you know, and speaking of that whole coincidence factor, sure enough, the United States just turned around and pumped 2,500 people into 2,500 troops into Australia. At the same time that that's been going on, they're signing defence agreements with Indonesia, and it just turns out 6 months beforehand, the US did a great big huge survey of all of Indonesia's waters, you know. And then finally, like, if you start looking around, and if you start looking at some of the Australian groups actually out there, you know, the people are actually turning around and they're taking satellite footage of Australia at night time, and you're actually seeing the HAARP rings actually showing up on infrared. You'll see in these areas where clouds going over, and then suddenly there's a perfectly cylindrical, multiple ring symbol going off, and you've seen two or three of these things. So, you know, when you get 11 factors that are repeating themselves, not just in this earthquake, but in the Christchurch earthquake, and the Indonesian earthquake, and the Japanese earthquake, and then, you know, going, come on, guys, this is not standard operating procedure. Something clearly unusual is going on. And, of course, you know, it's not just that it's the symptoms that you're seeing there are, as said, they involve large components of man-made factors in terms of where the installations are occurring and what's been seen there. You know, for example, we talk about this coincidental factor that we know that during Haiti, they just actually happened to be having a huge earthquake disaster drill there. And what were they also doing at the time when they're holding that drill was that they're holding a cyber command drill, which was to see, you know, how they would deal with the whole issue of the internet during an earthquake. Suddenly the earthquake actually occurred real life. They turned the exercise from an exercise into a real life thing, and then what they actually started doing was they started monitoring exactly how people use the internet when they were monitoring the situation.
Well, let's talk about more of that after the break, Ben. We've got Joe Carolyn here with us as well. We're trying to chase down Will Ryan. I'm not sure if we'll find him yet. It is Saturday, and he's a late night stalker. He's stalking the New World Order and all the Masonic shadowy games and whatnot. It's hilarious. And we'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen. You can call in too, 218-339-8525. Back in a minute. Gentlemen, to hour number two of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. The show that's all about conspiracy primers, detonators, initiators, main charges, nuclear charges, ambush sniping motorcades, and then acid and silver nitrate and mercury fulminate and presidential motorcades and saltpeter and charcoal and C4 and sulfur. On AmericanFreedomRadio.com. It's explosive talk radio, ladies and gentlemen. And my very special guest, Joe Carolyn, is also joining us. And we didn't have Ben Vigen on the line here. So, Ben, if you're listening in, you can call back if you want. But what I wanted to sort of talk about today is John Key and the particular scumbaggery that he seems to be inflicting on our country at this particular moment in time. Is the state asset sales and this march that's being organised to counter it, the Aotearoa is not for sale. Now, what do you think the government's spin is going to be on this? I mean, it looks like there's a fair amount of involvement from the general, you know, left community. What did you say, Joe? Labor, Greens, and Mana Party, that kind of thing. Can you explain to people just a little bit about what this protest is and specifically what it's protesting against? Because I had an argument with one of my listeners today that my feeling is that protests generally don't work and don't mean a hell of a lot. What means a heck of a lot more is if you're there with cameras and you report it in your own way so that you capture what the protest is really about. Because walking past somebody and having them here stand up, fight back, they don't actually know what's going on. It doesn't teach them anything.
Well, you're dead right. You know, I mean, protest, demonstrations, occupations, I suppose, is a further technique. But, I mean, all of those are irrelevant if you don't actually communicate to a wider group of people. So I think the first thing how protest works is that it sets up a locus in real space, in meat space, so it's not just chattering on Twitter or clicktivism on Facebook. It's actually people getting out onto the streets, right? And, you know, sometimes that can be supplemented with direct action, with the blockade of various points that can actually shut down an economy, right? Which actually then makes the system take things even more seriously. I mean, the point for this protest, Aotearoa is not for sale, is actually initiate a movement to gather the forces together for those people here in New Zealand who don't want to see this country sold out, not just to foreign companies, so I want to emphasize that, not just to Australian or American or Chinese interests, though a huge amount of economy here actually controlled from Australia, America, or China. But the whole idea that significant parts of the economy that have been built up by New Zealand workers at the years, public assets that are already belong to the people of New Zealand, would be sold off in a bargain deal for bugger all private interests, whether domestic or international. Now, we don't think that that is a good economic sense. A lot of these public assets actually return wealth back to the community here, and it allows the people of New Zealand to kind of, at least nominally, control their own water, control their own power. In the 1980s, it was actually the Labour Party here, the supposed party that was on the side of the poor, who sold off the bulk of our state assets. So things like the railways, the buses, you know, a huge amount of things were privatized, and the services became worse. They became more expensive. They weren't accountable to anybody except shareholders, many of whom are, you know, shadowy groups from overseas. We don't know who they are. And there's a second round now being brought in by this government to sell off the remainder of stuff. So I get your point about protest, but I think what we are about is trying to build a movement to stop the sell-offs, stop the neoliberal agenda, if you like. And what's interesting is that it's not just the radicals who've been involved in things like Occupy who've endorsed this protest, even though it's kind of more or less been led by us. But we've now had significant endorsement from bigger groups on the left here, like the Labour Party, the Green Party, the MANA movement, and Greenpeace just got that from 20 minutes ago. Now, that means with those kind of groups backing it, you could have a sizable mobilization of people, not just a few thousand, but maybe 10,000 or larger, which really then puts it down a watershed, a visible display of resistance on the streets. Because there's a very good slogan, I think, that we should bear in mind, which does show the power of protests, and it goes like this: what the parliament does, the streets can undo. And that's kind of what people have been doing in countries in Europe. Parliament can pass what it likes, but if there's protest and disorder on the streets, then governments actually have to back down.
I always find it's kind of like martial arts or the art of war sort of thing, where you apply pressure in very specific places. Because if you have a look at the elite, the people who actually run the politicians, who are more or less just puppetry, irrelevant objects, you think to yourself, you line up, how many protests have we been on and how many times have we actually gotten our way as a direct result of that one protest? And virtually none is the answer.
Well, I'm not too sure about that, Vinny. I think that every single protest, in fact, has an effect, right? And when there isn't any protest at all, that's where they really go further with their agenda. I think the people who rule society, you know, they don't have complete control, complete hegemony over people, and you know, they are worried about the power of protest. I mean, I've just been negotiating for the last 2 days with some of the biggest fast food multinationals on the planet, and they're absolutely terrified what I'm going to do in the next week or two, not because of the 15-20 workers that'll bring out and strike in any one fast food joint, but how it will affect their brand, how it'll affect their image, how it'll affect the customers coming in the door, right? That's what they're really concerned about. More about the brand than actually about the flow of profits, right? Now, it's the same with any protest action, I think. But you also have to have a strategy for escalation as well. I think people do understand that simple marches from A to B or voting from for policy and D has a limited effect. And I think that's why last year it was great to see people going further, you know, inspired by the revolutions that we saw in Tunisia and Egypt, the mass occupations of city centres in those countries. You know, so the occupation movements led to, you know, most of the city in America and Europe and even in New Zealand, right? The big lesson from 2011, though, was that a lot of those dictatorships were toppled successfully, not just through occupations of the city center, but also huge bike webs by low-paid workers. So that's kind of a part of the movement that we've been always looking at, the power of direct action, if you like. I think first you have to assemble numbers, some in some great quantity, and then you have to make the argument to people that they don't need to just rely on politicians, lobbying or petitions, but they've got the power by direct action in their community and in their workplaces to actually stop the system, you know. But yeah, no, it's looking like this will be very good, an initial kind of launch for this movement in April.
Did the protests actually stop the system per se? Because a lot of the ones that I've been on, I mean, all they essentially do is just stop traffic for about an hour while the protest passes through and then everybody gets on with their shopping.
Well, I think those are the ones that you've been on, and New Zealand is not at the revolutionary front of society by any means. But, you know, yes, the protests in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Syria, you know, the protests, the general strikes in Greece, in Italy, in Spain, Portugal, Italy in the last few months. They have stopped society. There are no buses moving. There are no trains moving. There are no airports open. You know, that's the power of workers in other countries who've got organized. And that's how you actually shut the system down. Now, I mean, even when you go that far, like they have in Europe, you know, the ruling class still rule. You know, they still have their state intact. They still have their police forces. They still own the means of production, if you like. That's why a lot of people in Europe who've closed the whole country down for, you know, for two or three days at a time are now talking about going even further and challenging the elite, challenging the 1% for power and take power back themselves, right? Just reading a really good report there from Italy about a bunch of workers who were laid off, you know, who used to build like a light rail system that was used in a lot of the cities in Italy. And of course, they're throwing that out and they want to, you know, continue building motorways and stuff. Those guys have just reoccupied, took over their whole factory and have started up production themselves again and are now cooperating with people in local towns to just do it, to ignore the government, and we'll just go ahead with it. So this actual challenge that goes on between people and power, I think there's different stages, you know. People start off first, I don't know, reading stuff on the internet, getting a leaflet. For a lot of people, their entry point into the rebellion, if you like, is going to the first initial demonstration where they can meet people of a like mind, not just listening to the radio or on the internet, but actually meeting them in real space. If you go on a protest, I've been on protests where there's been 1 million, 2 million people, you know, on the streets at the same time, either opposing the war or opposing George Bush going to
and yet,
you know,
and yet the war still went ahead.
if we didn't get out in the streets, how many more people would have died? The amount of casualties, I think, was reduced somewhat.
I'm not thinking about it in terms of, like, protest or not protest. That's not the choice here. The choice is how exactly do you protest? Because we see a lot of these interesting climate change groups. I mean, I'm not a big we should have a world government and tax everybody on the carbon that they exhale kind of person. But they have been doing these very effective and interesting protests with only handfuls of people, locking doors of major banks, gluing themselves to their super glue. Gluing themselves to their floors in the middle of their office spaces and stuff like that, you know, incredibly effective and interesting things that draw a lot of attention on very specific entities as the form of protest. Whereas former protest and mass movements or that kind of thing, I love going to because there's so many cool people there. You can learn a lot if you're there. The problem is that when it's reported later, you're not reporting anything that'll help people learn anything. It's just a number. There's 2 million people at this protest talking about such and such. Okay, cool. Next news story. That's how the coverage kind of gets beat up. Whereas you look at some activists, for example, in Canada, like in the battle for, Toronto, and they make hour, 2 hour, 3 hour long documentary films out of one protest and all the police tactics and all of the interesting conversations and talks and ideas and everything that had there. So it turns out that it doesn't matter really how many people are at the protest, it matters how much media expenditure is done on it, both on the alternative and the mainstream. Because I've seen protests that have only maybe 10 people of them get mainstream news coverage, and then protests that are against, say, the search and surveillance bill or whatever get 150, 160 people and way less news coverage.
Well, and different protests have different functions, don't forget, right? I mean, if you're out to build a movement, then you're to involve as many people as possible. So you've got the building events, which are, you know, the standard set piece, you know, mobilizations of huge amounts of people and a wide spectrum of different groups. And I think you can't underestimate that, because that is necessary to create social awareness within society, right? And if you put a significant amount of people out in the streets, that allows you to take things to another level, right? But there are protests that have very specific functions as well, you know, a strike, a picket line, to stop scabs from getting into a workplace, to stop customers from shopping at a place, you know, boycott campaigns for, you know, those very specific functions targeted at different things. I think all those things have different uses and can be applied in different ways. To talk about the mainstream media, I mean, it's true, they're part of the power system in society. I mean, I don't rely on mainstream media to your only to get our message across. And that's where I think alternative media, a lot of the work you do, for example, Vinny, very important in documenting in some depth the reason why a diverse group of people can kind of come to these protests. I think it's very good that you always give a diverse range of voices in any piece that you do, for example, you know. And this kind of work, this kind of, you know, it's not broadcasting, it's kind of like a narrowcasting, if you like, of a media activist now. Sharing it, the ability to share through YouTube, Facebook, whatever, you know, has actually helped the revolutionary movement, if you want to call it that, in the last few years in getting our messages across, right? However, I mean, a piece, no matter how slanted it is on mainstream media, you know, does help as well.
Yeah, well, any mention or whatever, it might make somebody cough up and try and, you know, research a little bit more into it. And if the alternative media has done its job, that information will be there for those who actually do want to see it. So after the break, we'll come back with Ben Vigen and Joe Carolyn. You're listening to the Vinny Eastwood Show. Join us in the chat room. Back in a few minutes.
Look at me, driving and I won't stop. How are we doing,
ladies and gentlemen? Live on the 8-foot show. Right here on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And by the way, if you haven't yet been to AmericanFreedomRadio.com and you're listening to the archives on Guerrilla Media or VinnyEastwoodShow.com or elsewhere, you know, go there, man. Oh, my God. There's so much interesting talk radio there. It's the best radio station in the world. It really is. And it's like host after host after host. They're all really good. It's pretty fracking amazing. Now, we have Ben Vigen. You've called back in, have you?
Yeah, I have indeed. Can you hear me?
Yeah, mate.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, it's interesting to listen to Joe. He's a very nice guy, and I've met him a couple of times. You know, he talks about the protest movement, but, you know, when you even look at Greece, you know, what happened was the protesters were, you know, looking like they were going to have their way. They looked like they were going to reject the IMF proposal regarding the austerity payments. Wham! They get hit by an earthquake, and suddenly they're going along with the IMF plan. And that's the interesting thing about the HAARP is that, you know, these earthquakes occurring, is it's not just the personnel, it's not just the anomalies, it's actually the geopolitical things that are occurring. And like, you know, we look at what's happening in Indonesia, you know, again, you've got this rather geopolitical situation occurring, which is Indonesia wants to buy Iranian oil. Suddenly, they get hit.
Ben, if I may, it means then that protest is only one part of a multi-headed attack that the resistance movement has to implement.
Oh, totally.
In addition to many other tactics and things that have to occur simultaneously, you know, analysis, espionage. I mean, think about all the different divisions of war departments and whatever. You know, you've got the Navy, the Sea, and what have you. A resistance movement, I think, is broken up into very similar categories as well. And protest is one form of attack that is complemented by many others. You know, we've got the Anonymous and all of this sort of stuff. It's a very eclectic resistance that we have sort of rising up out of the earth, as it were, being connected through the internet. And considering we have a very global menace that we're up against, quite obviously, it seems very poignant that a solution to this massive crisis, which is kind of going on everywhere, whether that be the war on your health, the war on the poor, the war on the this, that, and the other, all of it needs to stop. And the only way it really can, I feel, is if humanity adopts the tactic of the cactus. Cactus covers itself with spines covering every direction. So anytime, anyone, anywhere puts their foot on that cactus, they're going to get a little prick to remind them not to do it. And they're going to leave them alone. And I see the global resistance is doing this exactly right now, because even here in New Zealand, we start to have people who are now taking responsibility for the media in their particular area, for other things. And it's starting to work quite well, as if by magic, that suddenly people have started to work together. And in many cases, they don't even know that they're working together. Some people are protesting, some people are investigating, and they're all doing their own little things. And it works inexorably to defeat the enemy that we're trying to defeat, doesn't it? So in essence, it doesn't matter how you protest, just as long as you do something. The worst thing you can do is nothing. Any thoughts?
Talking to me? You talking to me? Ain't nobody else here. You must be talking to me. Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, yeah. About earthquakes and stuff. There was a small one in Greece, February the 14th, I think it was. And people did rally around. I don't think anybody was killed. You know, that kind of organic solidarity that you see when there's a huge crisis that hurts people. You know, the ordinary people of Greece, like, you know, solidarity to each other, kind of like what you saw with the Shenzhen earthquake in China. You know, I mean, there's a very dictatorial state with a huge, you know, army, you know, thought control, and, you know, dissidents are regularly targeted. Yet with that earthquake, you know, that did kill tens of thousands of people. Massive display of solidarity from ordinary people, volunteers, you know, risking their lives. This idea that humanity is only in it for its own good, you know, that it that its greed is the main motivating you know, in our society, that we will only do things for personal self-interest, is absolutely stood at it. When we do see these huge disasters and crises face ordinary people, I know in Indonesia, for example, there's a very strong and growing people's movement in Indonesia. I was involved in solidarity with that maybe a decade and a half ago, when it initially emerged against Suharto, who was a bloody dictator who involved the slaughter of millions of people when he came to power. And there is a strong people's movement in Indonesia fighting against the fuel hikes and the corrupt government there. Similarly, the with the disaster that's happened in Indonesia, the solidarity, the outpouring of mutual, you know, assistance from ordinary people has always been so, right? And contrast that with Haiti. When Haiti went through its disaster, one of the poorest societies in the world, the Americans sent in their troops, you know, with guns. People need food, guns, you know, camps who are dying of thirst in Haiti, people from other neighboring countries like Cuba and Venezuela who were sending free doctors, free nurses, and free health, free supplies, were actually held up at the airport by the American troops to use this disaster not to help people or give assistance, but to, you know, carry out their program of colonization in the region. You know, some people will use disasters, I think, for evil purposes. You know, what Naomi Klein calls the shock doctrine. When a disaster happens, people are so disorientated and you know, rightly focused on kind of survival, that this gives the you know, the powerful, the elite, the 1%, the chance to come in and radically restructure things almost invisibly, because people just look at the physical ruins of society. For example, New Orleans, all the state schools were destroyed by the hurricane, but they were all destroyed by the likes of Penny, you know, and when the schools they were rebuilt. By public-private partnerships. You know, shock doctrine, if you they use natural disaster.
What you can do, is you can draw the conclusion. I'm sorry, you've got to draw the conclusion here that what they do is they use weapons like HAARP to create that big shock so that they can go in and use their shock doctrine. You know, it's problem, reaction, solution, the old Hegelian dialectic. I'll create the problem and then I'll get everybody to come to me to save them. Well, and I'll accumulate all the power and all the wealth.
The power of people as well, you know, to resist this kind of stuff as well. I mean, in Haiti, for example, even though the people were faced with massive crisis and stuff, the results of this attempt to reorganize themselves from the bottom up. And, you know, when the quake happened in Haiti, you know, it did destabilize the military government that ruled, you know, backed by the Americans there. And a lot of prisons were reopened by the people and prisoners set free. And these prisoners were not murderers or rapists. These people were leaders of the resistance movement in Haiti, of the unions, you know, or else poor people. Who'd been jailed for, you know, trying to feed their family and stuff like that. So always within disasters, yes, the right can try and use it as a way to increase their power. But we can also, you know, I think the crisis shows that we actually need to help each other in this life.
Well, it's true that during disasters, people come together very quickly. Like in Christchurch, I thought it was interesting because, you know, a lot of neighborhoods in modern cities are, you know, people don't know their neighbors or anything like that. But in Christchurch, after the quake, instantly everybody's out of their houses, checking on everybody, getting the elderly people out of their homes and giving them help and giving them tea and giving them coffee and giving them blankets and giving them food and blah, blah, blah. They're doing everything for everybody instantly. Just straight away, you know, and I'm sure that the rest of the country did the exact same thing in their own capacity, donating or sending stuff down. There were heaps of people who went down to help out and caught flights and what have you. It just shows you the human's innate ability to want to help each other. Isn't that right, Ben?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, human beings do want to help each other. But even when we're looking at the whole protest movement, I think we do have to step back and be a little bit aware. Like, you know, in terms of what we saw was happening in Greece, was that, you know, we were seen on the front pages of and the newspapers of protesters turning around and throwing bottles, all dressed up in black with, you know, their masks over their face. I was actually speaking to people in Greece. Can you hear me?
Yeah, yeah. I was just saying that was the police, bro.
Exactly. But this is the whole situation. You know, even with Anonymous, you know, we have to be careful that we're not actually playing their end game. And you know, in terms of what we saw happening in London again, we saw a lot of, you know, agent provocateurs, and it can be very easy that the protest movement can actually be shaped in a direction that we want. So, you know, really, at the same time, while we're doing all this massive networking and Facebooking, you know, that can actually play into the hands, and we do need to kind of pull back to smaller communities and do rely on the people that we know. And, you know, what you said before, and I'm not necessarily a big fan of the march in the street myself. I'm more of a fan of the person that's actually proactively going out there and gluing locks, and as you might have seen in the news recently, you know, someone just broke in and chopped down a whole bunch of genetically engineered trees, and, you know, that's supposed to be a crime, but I don't really have much of a problem with that.
No.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about that. I mean, out in Glen Innes, you know, the community there has probably been made stronger by the attack on the state houses. Like, people do actually know their neighbours a lot more now. We've built a network of people who are actually doing that direct action, not
and you're right, Joe.
The locks of a corporation, actually, you know, putting locks in neighbours' houses, willing to occupy, you know, and be dragged out of those houses. So that kind of occupation movement, moving from the city centre now into the community, you know, occupy the hood, we have a right to defend our communities. And look at Christchurch, right? Now all the ruling, all the people of power, you know, fawning over themselves, rushed down there when the disaster happened, talking about helping the people of Christchurch. How are the working people in Christchurch treated now? I mean, treated like shit. You know, we've people living in garages still. We've got people whose houses were red zone and the compensation that they were promised. We have a lot more people who are unemployed, who've actually moved out of Christchurch up here to Auckland, who are all living in garages. You know, we had shocking treatment by some of the employers down there, workers who'd been laid off. You know, again, come back to the shock doctrine. You know, these people will use a disaster, and they have used the disaster in Christchurch for their own benefit. They use the disaster of River Miners for their own disaster, for their own, you know, profile, political profiling.
Well, the
ordinary people who suffered there, both in Christchurch or Pike River, you know, I think in the end feel used by these politicians.
Well, the Christchurch one's an interesting one because, again, you're looking at the whole geopolitics of the situation, which is, if Christchurch was a heart-based earthquake, you know, right off the coast of the South Island, there was massive oil reserves, and there's a lot of effort and a lot of energy being put into actually basically being able to actually access that. Stepping back from that, you know, you turn around and you see Joe's completely correct. What's actually happened is that, you know, they've turned around and they've said, look, this area is actually red zone. Instead of the process being dealt with quickly so that people can get on with their lives, they're holding them up, and eventually people are saying, well, look, we'll accept the government price. Meanwhile, you've got an American company called Ceres, have actually, you know, who were there in Haiti and they've been in most of these earthquake areas, have moved in. In the background, their property company is actually buying in and doing massive buy-ups of development in Christchurch. And it's actually, they're working hand and foot with our own government to basically have a situation which is going to be the rich once again get all the prime real estate and the poor people just get pushed off to the peripheral. You know, it's quite amazing how you see this happening in all these events around the world. When you turn around and you look at where these earthquakes are occurring, there's very much there at the hub of a geopolitical struggle between, you know, what the Americans would call the war on terrorism, which is really the war on the rich and the poor.
When they talk about earthquake recovery, what they're doing is talking about recovering all their assets and money and stuff like that off of everybody who's living there at the time, who's had all of it destroyed. How best can they reap their profits from you? This is the callous nature that we're dealing with here. People best wake up to this political reality. It's very sad, but it's the truth that there are people out there who have no conscience, who will use weapons of mass destruction against people covertly in order to basically rape your country, strip you of your rights, and steal all your state assets and money and what have you. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We'll be right back after the break. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on the American Freedom Radio Network all across America and internet streams around the world. And we also have Ifinity FM, who play the show in the middle of the night down in Southland. Good on you, boys. And various other little AM and FM affiliates around the place. Love you guys. You know I do. And we have Ben Vigen coming back from break. Ben, you're live.
How are we doing there, Vinnie? See, you're giving a shout-out to Infinity and a good part of the Southern Independent Media Alliance, which is a little part of how we're all working together in the same steps. And, I just wanted to go back to the whole geopolitical situation. You know, when people look at HAARP, it's like, you know, when you went back the first time it was used in 1993, you know, that was at the time when America was in a huge trade war with Japan. And a lot of the same situations were happening then are now being duplicated when the earthquake hit in Fukushima. In Haiti, you know, there's huge control at the moment for the battle of the resources of South America. You want to control Central America, you need to control Haiti. Indonesia, we've got the whole oil issue there. And then, of course, down in New Zealand, we've got the oil. So, you know, all the common denominator I see of all these areas is normally about the control about either the power or the minerals. And even, you know, when we get to the whole protest movement again, you know, even what's going on about, what Joe was going on about the Middle Eastern riots, well, interestingly enough, most of those riots occurred in Arab nations, and what it's actually really doing is it's actually made it very tribal and fractious. So you sometimes have to step back and look at even the protest movement, saying how much of the protest movement is actually genuinely coming from the people and how much of it is being provoked to meet that geopolitical end. And I don't think people really kind of comprehend the fact of how far in depth that these people actually plan. And it, you know, and it always boils down to it's about the money and the power.
Now, and I also wonder whether or not sometimes going out and protesting actually plays into the deceiver's hands to a degree. Like, for instance, if it gets out of control, and, you know, we're not really advocates of violent protesting or anything like that. And usually if that does happen, it's cops who are dressed up like anarchists who are doing it sort of thing. So that they the protest being there is almost like a tool that the police use to provocateur and make the protesters look evil and bad.
And
what I love also is that when I go to a protest and there'll be a couple of hundred people there, they'll pick one guy who has really rangy looking as dreads, and he will be the one person in the picture holding this big banner or whatever, like perfectly cropped. so that it's a great representation that this is what all these people stand for. I love it.
And that's exactly what happened in Greece the day before the actual riots were breaking up. They didn't show the thousands of families that had gathered there that had actually been basically pushed away by agent provocateurs. Instead, they concentrated on the violent aspect. And that's, for me, is that, you know, I'm a big believer in proactive protesting, but, you know, when people start turning around about armed revolution, I don't want to have anything to do with it. And if you look at it, Dr. Martin Luther King, Gandhi, these are people that actually, you know, they stuck to the non-violence method, and that's why they got rid of them, because what their methodologies were actually working. There's a lot you can do without actually having to pick up a gun. And let's remember, who makes those guns and who makes those bullets? And when you start relying on your enemies, supply, you know, for your supplies, you've got a real trouble. You know, every revolution you look at, when the armed level's gone down, all that happens is the scum rises to the surface, and you don't end up with an ideologist, you end up with the most ruthless beast in control. In other words, it just repeats the cycle.
That's why they call it a revolution, because revolution means to go in a circle.
Yeah, exactly, you know. So, I mean, you know, what we really need to be doing is looking at ways where we can actually confront them, draw them out to themselves without actually having to kind of go in there and start blowing things up, because once we start doing that, we're lost. And this is where people like yourself come into the equation, is that sometimes that camera is far more powerful than anybody's, you know, weapon. And if you can turn around and you can document, you can put the spotlight on that, they fear the light more than they do someone waving, you know, placards at them or throwing rocks at them. And they can get caught and constantly have that spotlight on them. That's when you're winning the battle. And that's what I find quite interesting, like, you know, when I look at some of the way that the media's been unfolding, or the activism media's been unfolding in New Zealand, we're winning quite a few battles in terms of the way that we're working together is getting good ratings, and suddenly the mainstream media goes, hey, wait a minute, those guys are good ratings, let's start reporting what they're doing. And then slowly we win the battle. But at the same time, we need to concentrate on the legislation, which, you know, as we're trying to do this, they're tearing that legislation underneath us so that we can't actually do our jobs, and that, you know, what is previously owned by the, for example, we have TVNZ and we have the Radio New Zealand, which are government-owned entities, now the law's changing so that those assets can be sold off. So we're constantly fighting this sort of rearguard action, if you will.
You know? Yeah, and, exactly. And you can't win a war on the defensive.
No, you can't. And this is, again, gets to the issue in terms of, you know, when you're dealing with the issue of HAARP, is that constantly we're always on the rear guard, that, you know, the media rush off and they speak to the geologists and they don't turn around and speak to the other, you know, the other fields that are out there, such as, for example, I said to you before, the FEMIS program, NASA's involved. That's where we can turn around and say, well, look, we know that they're going to, you know, try to belittle us by bringing out the geology card. So our thing is to try and do is get as many of those academics that are researching other areas and get them in front of the media before these events occur, so that people start to develop a bit of a social awareness. You know,
have you got anything to add to that, Joe, about media and social awareness?
Well, just that. I mean, I think that people also decode the media. You know, people just don't. We're not the believe in the hypodermic model that people have any brands that are filled with the ideas that the mainstream media, you know, pump into them. I mean, I look at Northern Ireland, for example, on the British occupation and all the channels there. Pro that, pro military, pro police. Yet when people watch the news, everybody would be aware that was propagandists. They're propagandists. So I think that in Greece, for example, everybody knows that there are elements of the Black Bloc who are agent provocateurs. I actually know anarchists, and, you know, I don't agree with anarchists, but I do know that some of them deserve the right to smash windows. I mean, their excuse is that the property damage or the sound of glass being broken is nothing compared to the sound of a child dying of hunger, right? I mean, they're lookout. And in first movement, you're going to have people who will not be satisfied with writing petitions or whatever. I think also in countries where states have used violence against the people, that the people do have a right to defend themselves. And even Martin Luther King agreed with that. Gandhi didn't get the British out of India just through salt marches alone. It was when the Indian Navy mutinied
Bombay and turned their guns around and pointed them at the British, you know, complemented with massive general strikes in India. You see, all of that is written out of history by people who want us to tie our hands behind our back. You've got to be able to use multiple methods, and I don't think, you know, writing a petition to Mr. Hitler to please let the Jews out of the camps, you know, would have worked. That very funny YouTube video about the environmental activists who, you know, attempt to protest Mr. Vader's Death Star, you know, is a good case in point, you know. So, in peace itself, many people see the images that the state has shown of, you know, Petra bombing and the Black Bloc, etc. But you see, the big thing is, in themselves, that they were part of that general strike, because it was millions of people who were on the general strike. And when they come home after the general strike and see images of the Black Bloc being repeated again and again and again, most of them just go, oh, for fuck's sake, this is the media cutting us out of our own history. Do you know what? We won't believe in it anymore. We'll make our own. And that's why in Greece, there are several occupied former newspaper companies have gone bust because of the austerity program that are now producing papers themselves. The activists have actually taken over radio stations and TV stations in many of the local areas in Greece during these days and broadcast things themselves. You know, I saw a great thing in, I think it was in Crete, where the local people just stormed into the TV station, kicked the news presenters off, went, all this shit that you guys show is propaganda.
You have to watch the language, you have to watch the language under FCC regulations here, Joe, but continue.
But they kicked them out. Joe does mention a very good point there.
Oh, and go ahead, Ben.
They let all the people have an open forum that could cast for hours and hours, and they invite in the people to speak themselves, you know, without these gatekeepers, without these controllers. And, you know, that does show that the anger level has reached a point in Greece where people no longer will accept the hegemony, the ideological state apparatus from continuing on in the same way. And it's one of the first targets of the rebellion is this control for the means of mental reproduction, if you like, the means of distributing ideas that will be contested in any modern revolution.
Indeed, and we don't really have enough time to go into anything else. So, Joe, if you could plug your website, and Ben, plug your websites. And, Joe, if you're available afterwards, we can actually do that debate with Will on Skype right after the show, and we'll upload it exclusively for subscribers if you have the time.
Well, my website is... You go first, Joe.
Good on you, Ben. My website is Socialist Aotearoa. That's the Maori name for New Zealand, the original name of this land. And that's Aotearoa. And I'm sure there'll be a link on Vinny's page.
And my website is Postman Productions, www.postmanproductions.org. And if you want to look at the heart stuff, and we've also got some interesting stuff there about radio contamination in New Zealand, to go to our investigative news section, just go to the front page.
All right. And thank you very much for that, Ben. Thank you, Joe. And we'll see you again later on, ladies and gentlemen.